Hello and welcome to the 7th edition of Stuff We Like. I'm David Simmons, and for the next half hour or so, we're going to be talking about stuff we like. And in this episode, we will be looking again at travel. There can be little doubt to those who've been to Italy that it is a rare privilege to walk the streets of Florence, steeped as it is in medieval and Renaissance sculpture, art, architecture, and political history. My family and I have had the pleasure of going twice in the past few years. We rent a small apartment, which is fairly inexpensive when you compare it to renting property in the UK. And once you take care of the flights, it's not a prohibitively costly holiday. The first time we saw many of the classic sites, the Uffizi Gallery, the Piazza di Michelangelo, walking past the Duomo every day. The second time, however, we explored it in a little more detail, checking out particular restaurants or parks. Halfway to the Piazza di Michelangelo, which overlooks the town of Florence on one side, for example, is a small rose garden hidden behind a wall, tucked away, and we would spend a few hours there, sometimes each day simply resting, eating picnics, reading books, or snoozing under the olive trees. Some way out of the town, reached by a bus on the other hillside which overlooks the town, is the small village of Fiesole. The thing about Fiesole which makes it so special is the lookout. You leave the village square and ascend a series of roads which take you to a vantage point from which you can see the whole of Florence laid out before you, the dome, the piazzas, the hillsides opposite. Even Fiorentina football stadium is visible. Back in the village, meanwhile, next to the street side shops and cafes, is a museum which houses a fully-sized Roman amphitheatre, a Roman hypocaust and baths, and the remains of a Romano-Etruscan temple, which is absolutely fascinating to walk around. Back in Florence, on the other side of the Ponte Vecchio, we discovered a delightful ice cream shop near a small piazza not far from Galileo's house. There they have a unique array of flavours, things like licorice, for example, and a refreshing mojito sorbet to die for. It's a joy to savour those ice creams as you walk back over the bridge, among the street vendors and buskers in the Piazza della Signoria. That ice cream shop is called the Gelateria della Passera, and it is on the Piazza della Passera, number 15. That particular piazza is quite small, but you'll find it just on the corner, and all of the ice creams aren't ostentatiously displayed, but they're actually hidden under small pans. So you walk in and have a look at the chalkboard, because all the ice creams are freshly made that day, and then you can see what there is for sale. Quite an astonishing place, and the ice creams are amazing. My family and I like to return to the same part of England. No matter how frequently we return there, we always know we will have an enjoyable stay. We know the towns, the coastline, the landmarks, the features, the things which make it beautiful, the things which give it character and which give it life. I'm talking about the Suffolk countryside and coastal towns. Only an hour or two from London, leaving eastward on the A12, you first hail the delightful small villages of Stratford St Mary and Dedham, with their picturesque churches and small high street. And just off the A12 on the Stratford Road is Hall Farm, which is a working farm and hosts a farm shop and has pigs, sheep and hens and an absolutely wonderful coffee shop, which boasts some of the best cakes and lunches to be had within an extensive radius. Driving on from there across the Orwell River, you eventually arrive at the turning for Aldborough on the coast. Driving the small road leading from the A12 to Aldborough, you will pass signs for Snape, which is a small hamlet which was developed by Benjamin Britten to house the Maltings Concert House, and itself has an array of shops, boutiques, galleries, coffee shops and pub, not to mention a couple of Henry Moore original statues. It's a lovely place to stop, to take photos of the boat or grab another coffee and recharge your batteries before arriving at Aldborough. Once you are in Aldborough, you can park along the High Street or in the front of the White Lion Hotel and walk along the promenade, past the large house which was owned by Benjamin Britten and Peter Piers, or along the High Street past the tiny cinema, the lighthouse restaurant, the galleries, the ice cream shops, Munchies Cafe, the pubs, the second-hand bookshops. Time seems to have frozen in places like Aldborough. When you visit, there is a sense of somehow being attached from the rest of the world, which is certainly an asset for any desirable holiday destination. The UK Tourist Board recently released a list of 110 things which you must do in the UK before you leave. And among that list was visit the Aldborough Fish and Chip Shop and sample the delights of their incredible fish and chips, preferably from the paper with salt and vinegar, and preferably sitting on the sea wall which overlooks the shingle beach that abuts the North Sea. A very long queue is inevitable when the fish and chip shop opens, but nevertheless it is worth waiting for. No visit to Aldborough can be complete without that experience. Before taking a turn, once again down the high street past the houses to the Moot Hall, which was built in Tudor times, or to the toy boating lake, or to the Italian coffee stand at the end of the promenade. Walking on past the upturned boats, you come to an expanse of shingle, which leads to Maggie Hambling's unforgettable scallop, which is a memorial sculpture to Benjamin Britten, with harrowing words carved in the shell from Britten's famous opera, Peter Grimes. Walk on, and you will eventually arrive at Thorpe Ness, a small town with hotels and one or two small shops, and a large boating lake called the Mere. You can sit and have a cup of tea and watch people struggling with their rowboats along the Mere, or you can hire a boat yourself for an hour or so and row out among the dragon's dens or moorings in the upper end of the Mere, where the reeds overgrow the muddied banks and you climb ashore the small islets at your peril. Overlooking the Mere is the House in the Clouds, which is a remarkable-looking property by any standards. But this tall building was once a water tower and can be rented for the right price, with commanding views of the whole area, as well as the nearby windmill, which overlooks the local golf course. Driving up from Aldborough, once again back on the trusty A12, you drive through or past villages with names like Saxmundham, Darsham, Middleton, Cheddiston, Wesselton and Yoxford, to the seaside town of Southwold. Like Aldborough, Southwold is reached off the A12 by a road, which leads directly to the town, a town which overlooks the sea and which is crowned by a white lighthouse. Southwold has a promenade, which stretches wide from the pier at one end, which offers slightly upmarket shops and distractions from the usual seaside pier, past an eye-catching array of multicoloured and very expensive beach huts which overlook the expanse of sandy beach below. The road then winds down past Gun Hill, where a series of cannons stand to attention, and have done so since the Battle of Sole Bay, the famous sea battle fought against the Dutch of this very town, which claimed the life of the Earl of Sandwich, Samuel Pepys's cousin, in 1672. Southwold, the town, has its own high street, which again hosts a series of coffee shops, galleries, sweet shops and toy shops. At the far end, from the sea, is the Adnams Souvenir Shop, where you can buy kitchenware, wines and, of course, the famous beer of old Southwold, Adnams, with its now varied series of flavours, each of which have names of a naval or seafaring theme, such as Gun Hill, Broadside, Ghost Ship or Explorer. As with Aldborough and many of the towns of Suffolk, when you visit Southwold or walk along the back fields through Blackberry Lanes to its neighbouring town of Walberswick, over a bridge which does exist, you do feel as though you're travelling back in time, to an age where the stresses and strains and hassles of 21st century life can truly pass you by. I cannot recommend a week or two in this delightful place highly enough, and will continue to return there for many years to come, and will doubtless revisit the theme of this coastal area again in future episodes of this very podcast. If you are interested in popping along to Suffolk, why not check out some of the websites of places you can hire cottages? A particular favourite of ours is Suffolk Secrets, where you can get very good cottages at quite decent rates in the Suffolk coastal towns and environment nearby. It's a great place for enjoying the wildlife, checking out the wonderful sea breezes of eastern England, and of course tasting the fantastic Adnams beer, something which is definitely going to feature in one of our Stuff We Like Food and Drink episodes. Hannah Walker.
Hello.
Hi, welcome. So tell us a bit about yourself, first of all, where you live now and where you used to live and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, I moved to Goodmayes about 7 months ago to work at Faith Action, which is sort of national network of faith-based organisations, sort of trying to encourage social action and community projects. And I graduated from uni last year doing international development, and before that I lived in Nepal for about 10 years during my childhood.
Okay, so international development, what made you want to do that as a degree?
It's just as simple as I was looking through the prospectus and it stood out to me. I never even knew it was a degree until I saw it was written down.
Right.
And it's just the combination of learning about sociology and geography and with an emphasis on poverty and why different places are developed to different degrees, and it just attracted me. It had all the things that I'd like to know about but never have the energy to actually look
explore,
up every three times. I thought it'd be a great degree to study. Not really sure where it would take me, but.
And that was at East Anglia.
Yes. Norwich.
Norwich. So, going back a bit further, then Nepal. You said you spent some time there. Would you say Nepal?
No, I say Nepal. I can't. Nepal. I think because people in Nepal say, yeah, they say it like Nepal, and I think people in England say Nepal. Anyway.
Yeah, because we're English.
I don't know what the right way is.
We elongate all our vowels. So tell us a bit about that experience. Why were you there, and how did it, you know, what kind of a place is Nepal?
Okay. Well, I was there simply just because my parents had jobs there. We moved when I was four. My dad previously worked for Department of International Development.
Okay.
In Thailand and Bangladesh.
So there's a theme of international development running
through
your family.
I mean, to be honest, a lot of people in my course have some kind of history with international development through going away or your parents' job or something like that. I think that's how you originally spark an interest. So my sister's also doing a degree in international development.
It just sort of runs in the blood. So your father then worked initially in the Far East?
He worked for DFID, and I think just got a bit frustrated with the bureaucracy and I don't know, some of the stuff that he saw going on, and he thought I'd want to work somewhere with a little bit more integrity or a little bit closer to his beliefs. And so he looked and he also wanted to get a bit stronger in his faith. So he's a Christian, but at that point was a new Christian.
Okay.
So he did a course with an organization called Youth of the Mission.
Yep.
And from there made connections with people in Nepal and eventually decided to work for Youth of the Mission in Nepal, still doing agriculture and sort of small-scale community development projects and church building, that kind of thing. That's
right, okay. And so where did you fit into all this, you and your sister?
I was four, so okay. I didn't have much of a choice. We moved out there. My mum was... There was three of us, and my mum sort of looked after us and did homeschooling for a little while, and we just had normal kid childhoods. And this is weird when people ask me about Nepal. Like, when I started my degree, I assumed I knew stuff about the world, because I've lived in a few different countries, and I just realised I know about living somewhere, but that I don't know anything about the economy. I don't know. I don't even know where it is in relation to other countries. I just know what it's like to live there. So it's quite weird. It's very different from choosing to go somewhere when you're older and being intentional about it. It's just sort of it happens to be where you grew up.
Yeah. So what was it like growing up there?
What's it like? It's strange. I was meeting up. I had a reunion last summer with lots of friends from my high school in Nepal, and looking back, it's very strange thinking about what life was like, because you do stick out very much and you get you know, people make comments on the street and things like that, and you always feel like you're observed. But you've also got this, you've also got this automatic superiority thing going on. People treat you better, and people automatically, positive discrimination, I suppose, all the time. And when you're young, you don't necessarily think to question it. Obviously, you know that you're not better than anyone else, but you just accept that this is the way things are, and because you look a certain way, you get away with things that other people don't get away with. And it's funny looking back on that.
That is interesting. That's similar to my own experience. Were there any specific places that you found enchanting you want to go back and visit, or...?
In terms of the places that I've lived?
Generally.
Well, weirdly, I've never really wanted to go back to Nepal until about a year ago. Even through my degree, I sort of felt like it would sort of smash my ideas of what home was like, because I know as soon as I go back, everything will be different, and you don't actually belong there, even though you feel like it was your home.
It was your home.
And so I didn't particularly want to go back until about a year ago, and I felt like it would be pretty exciting. And Nepal is just a wonderful place. The city is really dirty and smelly, and when I go into an alley and I smell a dumpster, it reminds me of Nepal. There's rubbish lining the streets.
But which city was this? Kathmandu?
Kathmandu. Mm-hmm. That's where I lived my whole life. But at the same time, it's really vibrant and it's really exciting and colourful, and I don't really know how to explain it. And it's so friendly.
Yeah.
And I've been to other places where people, it's a little bit more aggressive and busy. And Kathmandu is a very busy place, but it's also very friendly and welcoming place, and hospitality is such a important thing in the culture.
Did you go to restaurants and things, or what kind of a life did you have there?
Yes.
Parks?
No parks. I think of it as sort of a standard kid life, really. I mean, went to school, went shopping.
What sort of supermarkets did you have there?
There's two supermarkets.
Okay.
And sort of wander around and look at the different shaped plastic phones and all these, there's all the most random stuff there. You go into the touristy parts and look around. I mean, to be honest, our Kathmandu was fairly small. It was fairly limited to the few different places that we could walk to or cycle to. And the rest of Kathmandu, the vision I had when I was young of where I live would be so different to going back now. Because as a kid, you're very self-focused. So things like seeing little boys, like snorting glue and things like that, I didn't really affect me. I just thought, oh, please don't ask me for money. I just want to go get some crisps and stuff like that. So, yeah.
So, in terms of its countryside, what was that like? Is it mountainous there?
Yes.
Because you're on the foothills of the Himalayas, are you not?
Yes. Kathmandu is a very smoggy brown valley.
Okay.
And all around it, you can see the Himalayas on a good day, but often you won't see them for weeks at a time because there's just so much pollution.
Smog.
Your lungs get all coated in lots of crap when you're there. If you sort of travel an hour out, you get out into the hills and you can see beautiful mountains and things like that. And then that's the other thing about Nepal is the city is such a small part of the country. It's not urbanized. You've got two or three big cities and the rest is rural. It's completely different. So you travel a couple of hours and you're in a completely different world.
So you were aware of the cleaner air, I presume, and the mountain.
And you're aware of the like 15 people who are following you about 6 feet away. I remember going for a picnic with my granddad when he visited. And we went and sat on a lovely hill, like overlooking all the terraced hills, because everywhere's growing. There's no sort of empty land that you walk around on. It's all
agriculture.
Yeah. And And we just sat there, sort of five of us eating our sandwiches, and a few feet behind us, sort of maybe 10 kids, just sat there watching us without any food, just watching as we ate, because they're just fascinated with you. It's just quite a weird thing to get used to.
So, were you aware of poverty growing up, or deprivation at all?
Yes. I was aware of it in that I felt bad when I would go shopping, for example. And well, at one point in Nepal, in 2000, the royal family... Wait a minute, what was it? Sorry, 2001, I think, the royal family was massacred.
That's right, yes.
And the country just went into a very strange phase for about a year and a half, two years. And for the first few months after that, obviously, tourism was just stopped for a while. So you'd go into the... So you're a teenager and you sort of want to wander around and window shop in the touristy areas. And I just feel so guilty, all the shopkeepers lining the streets outside their shop. Come in. And I think, obviously, there was more abject poverty than that. But those kind of things affected you on your day-to-day life. But I don't think I was really aware of injustice of poverty. It was more of a fact of life until I came to England. And then I thought, oh, my gosh.
What have I been
living No one knows anything or cares. And you have this sort of arrogant mindset. I think that's probably why... I decided to do international development, really, is that seeing the difference, the different way of life and how it's completely random whether you're born with lots or you're born with no options.
Absolutely. And did you pick up the language at all?
That is one of the most embarrassing things, I think, about 10 years in Nepal, and I can't actually speak Nepali. I can understand Nepali, but not... because Kathmandu is very much rapidly developing place, everyone is really anxious to learn English. You're automatically spoken English to.
And
as a kid, you're just not bothered about learning another language. So I think my parents tried bribing the gardener's son to speak English to us, and to speak Nepali to us. But it didn't work. And actually... I was thinking about my old Nepali classes at my high school, and this sort of unquestioned racism of being a Westerner growing up in Nepal came to my mind of how difficult it was for Nepali teachers to teach English kids, or to any kid, well, school is international, but any kid who comes from a more developed country and has this sort of the feeling of I can't think of the word, but not superiority, but you're used to being treated differently, and I think they really struggled to teach us, and we were not very respectful, and I cringe so much when I think about it, but it's really telling about the mindset of growing up somewhere like that.
It's kind of post-imperial, but at the same time, it's a present thing. It's a reality for you at the time, isn't it? I'm intrigued by your sense of where home is. You grew up in Nepal, so that was your home, but then you came to Bristol, so that became home. Have you ever felt rootless, or do you feel rooted?
I think I feel rooted to my family.
Right, yeah.
In that, when I was in Nepal, I thought of Britain as my roots, and that's where I'm from, that's my identity, because no one in Nepal would think you're Nepali, even if if you're born there, you're so different. And then coming back to England, obviously, it did not feel very English, and I think that's a common thing, which you probably know about growing up abroad, and... not quite fitting in.
Yes, that's right. Not quite speaking the same accent.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff,
So I think, and I've done homeschooling quite a few times, and I think that I generally just find home where my family is, or I find home really quickly wherever I am. I'm not too bothered, really. So
fairly itinerant in that respect.
Yeah.
You found student life okay, living away from home.
Yeah, I take my, like, my couple of things that I put on the wall and then that's home, that's fine. I'm ready to stay.
Excellent. Hannah, thank you very much.
That's fine, it's been a pleasure.
Very many thanks to Hannah Walker there. And if you want to know any more about her work with Faith Action, just go to www.faithaction.net. Tom Ronan responded to a call for comments about travel by saying, if any of your dear readers happen to find themselves in Worth Matravers on the Dorset coast in England, then a quiet half pint in the Square and Compass public house is worth a go. There are very few pubs that can boast having their own fossil museum, but this is one that does. It is well worth a peruse, and the whole theme of the Dorset coast is also one that we shall be returning to in a later podcast, as there are many delights and features of the Jurassic coast on the southwest corner of England, to which I and my family also enjoy returning, similar to the Suffolk coastline, I guess. And that brings us to the close of this episode of Stuff We Like. But please don't go before you follow me on Twitter, at David Simmons, or Pinterest. Check it out, Pinterest Stuff We Like, where you can see all the stuff that we talk about every week. And you can also email me at Outlook, dhsimmons@outlook.com. And if you're interested in being interviewed and want to talk about anything that we have covered, be it food or drink, technology, travel, or the arts, please get in touch with me at any of my contact details and we can arrange an interview. I'm David Simmons, and this podcast has been brought to you by Absolute Productions, a division of Absolute Communication.